There's Ted's picture. What do you know? That's the world's largest meat industry website and the world's largest meat industry magazine. It's based in Chicago, and Ted is featured in this edition. So, one more comment, then I'm going to put Ted up here and you can work him over. I have a lot of respect for Ted's wife. They've got three children, and Ted travels the world. He's gone all the time. What does she do? She's looking after those kids and looking after the home and doing an excellent job of it. That's Ted's wife, Lori. Now, having said all the good things about Ted, I want you people to just pick him to pieces. Ted, you're on.
You're not going to believe this. I have listened to speeches since I was raised down here south, and you know what that means. I used to be on the stand, and I've heard speeches for almost 100 years. This is one of the most brilliant speeches I have ever heard. He's so fluent and so relevant, and tightened it up so well. Most of us try to fight. Most of us are here not to learn a lot of new things, but to find out what the problems are on the edge of new things, right? That's where we ask the questions. I can't find any problems. Where are the problems on the edge of this? I've raised cattle most of my life, so I know some of this, but you tighten it up so, is there any... I'll try one on here. Would global warming shifting the climate north and making deserts south of us and pasture lines north change it, or give me a problem.
Okay. I'm not sure which line to take on that one. Do I accept the global warming as a reality, or do I claim that it isn't? If global warming proceeds, a couple of things comes to mind. One is we'll have a new route to Asia, and that's through the Northern Passage. And in fact, that gives a certain transportation advantage. Again, likely would be a stimulation for northern Alberta. It would likely move the cattle production environment. Again, by decade, as it warms, would move further north. And eventually that, going out of Tuktoyaktuk would likely be a major shipment point into Asia. It actually brought up for the first time, although our current federal government doesn't like to talk about global warming very much, sovereignty of Canada's north took on a new dynamic, because when that waterway opens up and commerce moves between Europe and East Coast North America across our north to Asia, many sovereignty issues will start to emerge. For example, who's going to regulate dumping of bilge water, and what happens when the first major oil spill happens? And that'll be a new route for oil going to Asia. So these are issues that are not directly cattle, but they're very directly Canada. As global warming moves, vector seasons change. And that's, for example, the vector that's for blue tongue, the vector that's for anaplasmosis, biting flies and mosquitoes. Pests today don't live long enough in the western prairies to be able to propagate the diseases, anaplasmosis and blue tongue. You warm up much more, and they will do very well, thank you, in the western prairies, and there will be the introduction of more diseases. One of the benefits we've had is a freezing winter. We don't drench cattle. We don't dip cattle like South America does, because we have one of the best pest controls around is a freezing winter. You reduce the number of freezing days, and you elevate the low temperature period, and we will have more pest problems. We have more pest management issues that we'll have to deal with, and more formerly thought of as foreign animal diseases will be Canadian diseases. So these are issues that come up. Offset, we'll be in the basket for a few decades. We'll be a long grass prairie versus a short grass prairie, and that'll be more productive for cows. But these are all transient, right? You keep warming, and then you start to burn off the south, and you introduce more problems. So I kind of like the way things are kind of right now. I'm not sure I can do much about it, though.
look at that. I was giving him an A plus. It's got to be A plus plus. I thought I'd talk to him, and he goes, terrific, man.
Thank you. So I said, how do you know so much about this stuff? And I said, it's really easy. My knowledge in this area is 100 miles long and 2 inches wide. So as long as you keep it in the groove, I should be okay.
Congratulations, good presentation.
Thank you.
From what you said, I understood that your major problem is penetrating the markets and the audience. Pre-penetrating.
Yep.
My question is this. I should make a statement first. I spend a lot of time in the audience. And I found out that North American approach to marketing does 99% nothing. You have to cater the marketing approach to their culture, which is on a personal basis, mm-hmm. on all kinds of other different things. Have you done that and still hasn't worked?
In fact, in Asia, it's re-penetrating Asia is important, but it's market access. And first answer to your question, you have to get access to a market before you can promote it. Right now our problem is getting access to the markets. And quite frankly, we have a bit of a cultural, the same thing you talked about in trade promotion and market development exists in market access. And as soon as you position yourselves, Canadian government versus most Asian governments, and say, we're right, you're wrong, change, you are in for a lot of resistance over a very long period of time. We're starting to see a slightly different approach from Canada, which is using a little less rhetoric. It has to be science-based. It has to be this. And a little bit more movement of trying to give what's needed on the other side. Save face, save respect, show respect, and show a degree of flexibility on our side so that they can show some flexibility on their side. I remember that 6 months into BSC, sorry, 3 months into BSC, when the investigation was nearing completion on our first case, USDA had sent U.S. regulators up here to work side by side with Canadian food inspection regulators on the particular case and investigation. Japanese Minister of Agriculture contacted our Minister of Agriculture and asked if he could also send regulators to come and work beside ours on the investigation to help and to understand. Our government refused that. While the Japanese government knew that we accepted American regulators working alongside ours. That set a huge gulf that has never really been healed up since. And we set the message, we know where our priority lies, we know who our allies are, and you're not it. And it was totally wrong. On the market development side, to answer your question directly, yes. Our first office in the world, the Canada Beef Export Federation, opened up was in Tokyo, Japan. We opened up our head office in Calgary second. Then we opened up in South Korea, Seoul, Taipei, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Monterrey, Mexico. And all of them are staffed with local engaged. So it's Japanese selling Canadian beef in Japan, inside their culture and inside their business practices, with Canadian companies demonstrating flexibility to meet specifications. That's one of our service points of differentiation. Canadian companies will tend to recut how an international client wants it in a way that a single plant can, where our larger competitors out of the U.S. don't have that flexibility. It's more of, by the way, we have it. In Canada, we've had more flexibility. That's how we got from 24 million to 500 million, and that's how we're going to eventually get to 1.5 billion. But we need formal market access in order to promote our products.
My question was kind of answered at my table, but I'll ask it to you and for the sake of everyone here. That's a two-part question. The first is, how does our numbers match compared to the U.S. as far as production per year? And also, does the cases of BSE found in Canada reflect the quality or frequency of testing in Canada compared to the United States?
Okay. U.S. is about 9 times larger than us. But our exports have been virtually the same, and that's because they export 5-6% of their production. And we export, and when we're healthy, we export over 60 up to 70% of our production. When we're healthy, that's when we're really able to generate value in our portfolio markets. So, but they're about 9 times, 8.5, 9 times our size totals. We're 1.6 million metric tons. They're about 12 million metric tons for size of industries. Great question. By the way, if anybody wants to keep score, the score is 9-2. And that is, we've had BSE diagnosed in 9 Canadian cattle, 8 of them diagnosed in Canada, one of them was exported to the United States, but it's 9 Canadian cattle, and they've diagnosed cases in 2. Their 2 that they've diagnosed are both animals that are claimed to be 10 years and 12 years of age. Ours are, our oldest is 15 years of age, born in 1991, and our youngest was only 50 months, so 4 years plus 2 months, and that was born in 2002. You either diagnose more animals and diagnose them later because you have more BSE or because you have a better surveillance testing system. And I think the real, while I'd love to say it's only diagnosis and surveillance, it's likely a combination of two. We have what we call a BSE cluster in Alberta. And that all comes from where animals were imported. And we imported lab animals from the UK and from Europe prior to the United States. We developed an expertise in embryo transfer, AI, way before the United States because we allowed the importation prior to the United States. We had a more brisk business. We had more cattle coming in. Toward the end, in the 1980s, we were obviously bringing in some or a few cattle that were already carrying BSE with them. We know that one or a few died in Western Canada, and their carcasses were rendered in Edmonton. This is a result of us being very aggressive on genetic improvement, having more European cattle focused in one area. That infected meat and bone meal went out and got fed. We know that our first case born in Canada was 1990. We only shut off the border in 1990, so we know that we had first-generation infection back then. We, up until 1997, we never had a ruminant feed ban, so infected feed continued to circulate, and we got a number of cases between 1990, 1992 to 1996, 1998, right up around that feed ban, and then we've had 4 cases definitely born after the feed ban, which were based on mistakes. They call them incidental and accidental mistakes. In almost all cases, it was individual feed mills who didn't sequence their feeds properly. A load of chicken feed was done, and then they didn't clean their mill completely, and then they ran cattle feed. When they ran the cattle feed, some of the chicken feed that may well have contained ruminant meat and bone meal that carried BSE infectivity was mixed in and delivered. Those cattle were fed it. Some got it. That's how we had our 4 cases. 3 of them for sure. The 4th one, the data is just not available. But that's how we got it. So we know how we got it. We probably have a bit more BSE concentrated on a per unit number in this area. But we also have an incredibly effective surveillance system that's finding more. And so it's likely a combination of both.
So by that answer, would you say that the problem with BSE infected found cases should decline as the years go on?
Well, for sure. Our feed ban, while it wasn't perfect, you look at the incidents that we have. If we had no feed ban, we'd be diagnosing, many tens or hundreds of cattle a year. That's how fast it spools up by now. So our biggest year is we diagnosed 6, and every year we get further away from the basic implementation and the effective implementation of that feed ban in 97, fewer animals will have been infected because it's only these accidental or incidental cases that allowed one more flip to happen. In June of 06, we announced we're going to implement an enhanced feed ban, implemented in June and December 07, when it'll be fully implemented. And at that point, that's kind of like a big roll. And that's all these tissues, specified risk materials, that can carry infectivity will never be allowed into the rendering process to produce feed for any animals. So that ruminant meat and bone meal that's used for animal feed or pet food or fertilizer won't contain those original risk materials in the first place, so that if there is an accident, if there is limited exposure, the risk of BSE is no longer attached to that feed, that ruminant meat and bone meal. And that's the going from a strong feed ban to an even stronger feed ban it's going to virtually eliminate BSE, maybe instead of eliminating it over 15 to 18 years, it'll likely eliminate it in one more generation, 10 to 12 years. So it's already decreasing. It'll decrease faster with the enhancement, but we have an effective feedback. Otherwise, we have a lot more BSE.
I just had one more question, unless there's someone waiting in line. That question is, what are our current marketing campaigns in these other countries in which we're trying to be involved in their markets? Are we making them aware of our different quality controls, of the numbers and the reasons why these BSE cases have existed?
We've got two basic strategies, markets that are open and markets that are closed. There's some similarity, but there is a difference. Once markets are open and trade starts to happen, the concerns over your history of BSE evaporate by each extra ton that comes into the market. It becomes a non-issue. So you go back to strong environmental, strong animal health, strong food safety, but not really focusing on the BSE controls so much because, quite frankly, it becomes not very important in the minds of the importers, distributors, retailers, or even consumers. The reality is most consumers attach the confidence that they have in their favorite supermarket to all the products in that supermarket. So as long as the government allows it in and their favorite supermarket agrees to sell it, consumers will generally attach pretty good confidence to that product. So don't spend a lot of time talking about BSE. Talk about quality. Talk about bright red, bright white, good marbling, healthy environment, good people, all the things that are Canada. That's where we focus in. Really driving the brand image for Canadian beef in markets that are open. To the trade, we keep them informed of all new developments. We keep them informed on size and nature of the industry. Productive capacity is growing. We keep them informed on all of that. And we talk openly about the market access process and status in their market because our best friends are the importers of our products that they can have the ability to influence their own governments. In markets that are closed, the goal is to keep the smell of death off of your industry. If we've been out of Korea for 3.5 years, left alone, they would assume that we are an industry of full collapse, because that's ordinarily what happens when an industry has BSE, an industry that has retired the battleground, is no longer interested, an industry that has no capability of ever coming back, and an industry that has lost interest. It's just the smell of death. Our entire focus there is on trade, 95%. 5% is on consumer because they can't see our product. We don't want to sensitize them. But on the trade, then we do a lot more detailed work on status of surveillance, case communications, intervention updates, comparative analysis of what we do versus what others do, focusing on the safety of product. We do it at all levels, as well as talking about productive capacity, intent, and ability. The fact that we have goals set for their market in the future so that they're going, wow, This market's doing the right things. This market is focused on our country. The problem is access. Then they can help us influence their government to reopen so that there's momentum ready to move as soon as it opens. We're not flat-footed. As soon as Korea opens, we will trade. And in part because of there's no new information that trade needs. The importers, distributors, retailers, and restaurants, they're ready for our product. That's what we do in preparation for opening.
Thank you very much, Ted. You're an expert on the subject.
Good talk.
Thanks.
Ian McLaughlin, University of Lethbridge. Great to have you with us again. You were here last fall.
Yep.
About this time last year.
Yep.
And at that time, I said, what about Europe? Surely we can run hormone-free and get in there. And you said, it's not the hormones that's the problem. It's the European protectionism. But it's something we're looking at.
Yeah.
So what's new on the European front?
Okay. We took it back to our industry last year about Europe and took a look on whether we're willing to be more flexible on hormone-free and to recommit to the protocol to end up supplying product that qualifies for Europe, and also took a look at Europe. And I said last year it looked like Europe was turning into a more of a net importing market. It's most definitely continuing its net importation increase. Europe has indicated more flexibility and willingness to work with us on the import protocols, not to remove hormone ban, but to make the rest of our system easier to register new plants. And that's because Argentina cut them off. Argentina, because beef prices were going high in that country, put an export tax that stopped exportation of beef. Biggest market for Argentina, Europe. Second largest supplier to Europe, Argentina. Europe realized that they were at risk of political instability from the main suppliers of South America. There's more flexibility. We've consulted our industry, identified the major restrictions that we have to remove in the protocol for us to return to Europe, shared that information with Government of Canada, with the EU Canada Agriculture Working Group. They presented those restrictions that we need to have revisited. And for example, now all beef processing plants in Canada use steam pasteurization. Big steam cabinet. Carcasses go in, they're subjected to massive volume of steam. They come out, shot with cold water to bring it down. It reduces bacteria counts. It's what we do. Europe doesn't allow that. So we need to have them allow the use of steam pasteurization because our plants can't run without it. It's part of their HACCP. One example. There's a couple of others. We just have to have that done. That was presented. Europe was quite amenable to a number of these, and they're in the negotiations, while at the same time, two plants are now formally taking the steps to be registered in Europe. One is Rancher's Beef at Balzac, Alberta. The other one is Natural Valley Farms in Rosalie, Saskatchewan. Those two are interested in going ahead. We're actually working with them in advance on identifying potential trade partners, working with our international network that we know out of Europe. They're in active discussions. They're a year away of being able to supply because you have to capture the calves on the ranch and have them specifically inspected by a federal vet or designated vet before those calves leave. You have to get them around branding to palpate the ear to make sure that there's no hormone implant. And if you miss them then, you can't requalify calves until the next year. So I'd say this is not going to happen in the 2006 calves, but the 2007 calves will likely, we'll start to see Canadian beef moving back to Europe in late 2007 or early 2008. So, yes. And we're still not in a position to open a representative office. In Europe, our industry has said not until one or probably two plants are actually registered, actually procuring cattle, and in a position to sell, then our industry will go and establish a representative office to drive the market for their products.
That sounds like a really exciting opportunity and a redirection. CBF has been looking towards the Orient and looking towards Mexico, so that's a whole new direction. You did mention the two smaller plants that are on their way to becoming certified to get into the EU market. And that makes me want to ask about the 20-odd new generation co-ops that were proposed for locations from Salmon Arm all the way to Atlantic Canada. Salmon Arm was up and running, of course it was closed. All kinds of opportunities for producers to take an equity stake in the industry. All kinds of opportunities for small Canadian community groups to take some market control away from the big processors that have been lampooned in Canada going back to the beginning of the 20th century. In the event, it seems that Canadian producers haven't been willing to put in the equity into those small community-based plants. A lot of those have been abandoned. We saw the Pincher Creek proposal, exciting idea, really appears to have been abandoned in the last, it was in the Herald, I think, in the last month. I wonder if you could comment on why the smaller processors haven't been able to be more successful to provide an alternative to Canadian producers.
A lot of the business plans were predicated on a high degree of focus on exports, and access hasn't come online, and those that have had entered has been difficult. Also, it ain't just the money. Packing plants are difficult to run profitably. You have to be expert cattle buyers. You have to be expert processors, and you have to be expert sales. And honestly, at a national level, availability of qualified management in all three of those, there's not many. It's a real slim population, and if you're working in a plant that's operating, at least, and relatively stable, very few individuals are willing to be taken out of that environment to a high-risk startup, and so most never got past that level. They're very difficult to run, manage, and run profitably. And I've got to say, some of the business plans that I saw, basically their point and purpose was to pay more for cattle. And if the point and purpose of having a packing plant, irrespective of who owns it, is to pay more for cattle, you will go broke. And so that business model doesn't work. And I think as a lot of these business plans got closer, you can't pay any more for the cattle than you pay for anybody else. You'll only distribute funds out of the profits, most of which have to be reinvested because depreciation rates and everything else in these hugely intensive plants are high. So you're only going to take a little cash out, and you're going to enter a market that has its own set of risks and huge management requirements. A lot just kind of went, it's really difficult. So that's a number of them that I'm kind of a little bit familiar with. Hit that wall.
Any other questions?
Yes, I have one. My name is Cheryl Bradley. And in one of the answers to your question, you mentioned the values that consumers abroad and in Canada put on various aspects of the beef production in order to make a decision about wanting to buy that product. And one you mentioned was environment. And I'm assuming you meant that Canada is a clean environment to raise cattle. Is that correct? That's one of the selling features you've identified?
It is. There's two, but there's nuancing and details are important in that. First off, it's all at the macro level. When you're moving products a long ways away, the micro economies or micro environments are not relevant. It's macro environmental levels. So we're blessed with a very large land mass and a very small population with lots of water and little industrial activity. That results in relatively cleaner water. We also have extensive agriculture, which uses less fertilizer, which is actually a problem because it leads to increased erosion, but still less fertilizer, less pesticides and herbicides because of our winter. You put all that together, and at the detail, on a macro level, it's a pretty good story. But all that is just a little bit of support to the uninformed perception of Canada held by most people around the world, if they know anything about us at all. We're a little obscure, we're kind of north, we're pretty cold, there's snow, there's trees, and there's water and waterfalls. And we're pretty trustworthy, we're not aggressive, and the detail simply helps to substantiate some of the perceptions that are already there. That's how far we go, we don't go any further.
It's my observation, but it's just a gut observation, that domestically, it may be that the younger generation is moving away from eating so much beef. I don't know what your surveys show. Because they perceive it as a product that's hard on the environment, for example. I don't support that view.
Yeah.
But I think there is that perception. And so I'm just wondering what your industry is doing. And you may not see those trends. I'd be curious to know if you see those trends in the export market. And then I'd be interested in knowing what the industry as a whole is doing to ensure that you're addressing very real environmental issues. I mean, it's a huge question, but
Yeah. Maybe
you can give it.
Sure. You know that 2 inches wide? We're right there at the edge for that one. So, two things. Environmental concerns, when most of our international markets are not so highly held as they're held here. In part because, one, either the reality of the human load on the environment is so low here as compared to our destination market. You look at Japan. They do a wonderful job on addressing environmental issues, but they do have 124 million people on land base the size of Vancouver Island. It's a challenge. It's a human load on the environment. So whether it's dioxins from previous garbage burnings or whether it's just the pressure put on their fresh water supplies, we, relative to that, look like we're empty. There's nobody here. And so that, again, it's not, we automatically are assessed a larger environmental capacity that's relatively more stable. If you look at other markets such as Mexico or really mainland China, wherever income levels are low enough, the requirement for environmental sustainability is not very high because food production and survival are far more important than environmental sustainability and improvement. Quite frankly, a clean environment is a consumer attribute held most highly by the wealthiest people in the world because we have that luxury. of wanting, demanding, and getting and paying for a clean environment. Most are not putting value judgments whether it should or shouldn't be that way, but the reality is, it is that way. And so for us to even be thinking and talking about environmental issues in Canada puts us ahead of many of our lowest income destination markets, because they're not there yet in reality. As far as domestic consumption, we're not seeing particularly changes in levels of consumption, even at various different age cohorts. There was concern that the emergence of veganism or quasi-partial, just when my friends aren't around, vegetarianism was a concern. There seemed to be something happening. In fact, that age cohort, as it moves on, seems to be moving back into a mix of meat and others, for whatever reason. So that seemed to be kind of a transient issue. The percentage of dedicated vegetarian consumers in Canada hasn't moved off about the 2% level, between 2 and 3. So while that's a number we should focus on, it's the 97 to 98% which do consume meat that are our focus on. And yes, environmental sustainability is important. In Alberta, you've got, for example, Alberta beef producers do cattle and fish, which is preservation of riparian or near-to-water habitats to build water quality. There's a new national producer group that's working with the federal government. This is designed for producers to provide environmental services through, if it's the old Kyoto model, then that's by providing carbon sequestering or storage through grass, or by delivering cleaner water and a downstream municipality. If producers incur costs, that they will actually be compensated for that. It's a new national program that's being considered, initiated by producers. So there are many different actions being taken by in various different provinces and nationally to address real environmental concerns, and also to address the very wealthy consumer need for us paying attention to the environment. Both of those are happening. Is it perfect? No. Is it better than it ever has been? Yes. Is there going to be more? Absolutely.
Well, we've run a little over time. We got balled up there on these speakers, but not. Just don't forget that the two announcements, next week we'll have a discussion on income trusts, and then on the 7th, Tuesday on the 7 p.m., Tuesday on the 14th, Lethbridge Public Library will be talking about the Canadian Wheat Board. Thanks to y'all for coming, and thanks again, Ted, for all your knowledge.